Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to I Was There Too. My name is Matt Gourley. This episode comes to you live from the Regent Theater at the Alamo Drafthouse screening of The Running Man with screenwriter Steven D'Souza. He wrote The Running Man. He wrote Die Hard. He wrote Commando, 48 Hours, many, many others. He played a vital part in the crafting of all these movies, which normally this show, if you're a regular listener, is where I sit down with people who had smaller, significant roles in great scenes in cinema history. But Steven had a million stories about the films that he worked on, and in many ways embodied the energy of the films from that era in a way that I'll just let you experience yourself. He was a wonderful storyteller and actually put some cinema myths to rest as well as creating new ones. I don't know. It's a whole journey. I had a great time talking to him. One topic of conversation is how there is an entire universe of films connected under some of the elements of his screenwriting. Most notably, the fictional location of Valverde, which is the country where Franco Nero's character from Die Hard 2 is from. It's referenced in Predator, in Commando, even going as far back as The Bionic Woman, and on into Denzel Washington's film Ricochet. If you Google the Valverde movie universe, you'll find out more about it. I love talking to Steven and how all of these films were connected. My one regret is that I didn't cover one important topic, and that is his use of exploding hockey pucks from The Running Man to Die Hard. I didn't put that connection together until re-listening to this interview, but maybe another time. Thank you to Brett Berg and the Alamo Drafthouse for putting all of this together, and to engineer Sam from Earwolf for coming out and recording it. I couldn't have done it without you. This is a long one and a long-winded one in the best way, so buckle up, everybody, and enjoy.
The films, The Running Man, and Die Hard. The years, 1987 and 88. The role, screenwriter. That screenwriter, Steven D'Souza.
Good evening. Thank you. Thanks for coming out. I always love doing shows here. My name is Brett, and I'm the creative director for Alamo Drafthouse Los Angeles. And coming to downtown in 2018. I'll dispense with bullshit and bring out my Q&A moderator for the evening. Everybody, give it up for Matt Gourley.
Oh. Hi. Hi, everybody. Hi, Brett.
Yo. So what is it about this movie?
What isn't it about this movie? Like neoprene sweatsuit sport onesies? Muscles? In all the wrong places?
Yaphet Kotto in a spandex outfit. Hot.
Yeah. Maria Conchita Alonso and Richard Dawson. Dickie Dawson. Are you guys ready for some Dickie Dawson tonight?
We were talking about how he is absolutely perfect in this movie.
Richard Dawson. I think he's physically incapable of not extending his pinkies at all time. Watch that in the film. I had to watch this film to kind of devise some questions yesterday, but watch how his pinkies are all... They're just fully erect the entire time.
He perfected it on Family Feud when he would, like, survey. Yes!
Yes.
Hand motion.
Yeah, made all the better by his cuffs flipped up the other way. So it's just, but yeah, it's art.
So, Steven D'Souza, who not only... Yes. who not only wrote this film, but also wrote many things you have seen, such as 48 Hours, Commando, Die Hard, and directed Street Fighter with Jean-Claude Van Damme and Raoul Julia. He's a great satirical mind. This movie is full of the most cutting shit possible. But it was a lark. They didn't know. We all didn't know.
Well, it literally at least begins in the year 2017.
The movie opens with this. Yeah. Well, I mean, it opens with this prison camp amazing sequence, but then it cuts to downtown Los Angeles, 2017.
Yeah, there's a pyramid. There's a pyramid in downtown Los Angeles. It's in the movie, and hopefully when you walk out tonight, you'll see it.
Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, guys. See you after.
All right.
Technical difficulties.
Bullshit!
It's showtime.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's the man that wrote the words you heard tonight, as well as Die Hard 1 and 2, Commando, 48 Hours, many more. Let's have a big round of applause for Stephen D'Souza, ladies and gentlemen.
Anyway, I want to thank you. It's working? Yeah. Yeah, I will thank you all for coming, and I want to thank this venue. I think it's a wonderful civic action that they broadcast President Trump's address to the Congress tonight. And are we going to run the movie now?
I was going to ask you about that. I didn't want to start with the unavoidable political...
Can we change seats on yeah. Southpaw and the whole city here? Okay. All right.
You like to drive.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get to that. Let's get through the political aspects of this film because, well, I mean, we literally have a reality television star in the Oval Office. There are not one but two United States governors in this.
Yeah.
When you were making this, like, solidly
satirical... It's not my fault.
When you were making this solidly satirical film, did you have... any idea the amount with which entertainment and the state would merge in the future?
Well, we had already had the movie network, of course, which was, you know, in the 70s and was extrapolating where things were going. And we're sort of there now with Fox. Fox is like the network in the movie, The Network. And when I came aboard this movie, what's interesting is it was written by Stephen King under a pseudonym because his agent at the time said, you're writing so many books, you're going to be overexposed. So he wrote this book under a pseudonym. Now, in fact, when the studio bought the book, they did, you know, the fellow was an independent producer, was in an airport on a layover. He bought the book and said, this is a great movie, and he took an option on it, which was a modest payment with a big bump later down the line. And when he took it to the studio, Rob Cohen, who's now a well-known director, but this time is a studio executive, he said, boy, you made a lousy deal. Why is the second payment so high? Then that's when I realized it was Stephen King. Now, in the book, he shows a future dystopia where there's a worldwide depression that is so bad that the hero, who is sickly and tubercular, can't get work. He's got a sick child, and his wife is turning tricks to get medicine. And the whole society. So as soon as you cast Arnold, you go, well, you know, sickler and tubercular is out. And the worldwide depression, he can't get work, so he goes in the game show. But Arnold could get a job delivering pianos door to door, you know. So you have to, I didn't say I have to destroy Stephen King's vision, but like you tailor the movie like a suit. And in the book, Stephen King's writing this up in Maine, like in 1981. I don't know why they don't have reception up there. He didn't watch television. But the game show portion, the studio portion of the book, is like five pages in the novel. And the host is a different guy from the producer. The producer's really the prick. But the game show in the book, it's like a game show in the 1950s. You ever see reruns of You Bet Your Life with Groucho Marx? That's what the game show's like. There's a guy at a microphone, and a girl comes out with a box around her neck. And the runners pick an envelope, and that gives you your head start, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. Not sort of understanding how television works, Stephen King, a brilliant guy, And I'm in good company. He doesn't like The Shining either, you know. So I figure I'm in good company with Stanley Kubrick. In the book, the runners, the show is on for a month, right? It's on every night for a month. The runners volunteer to win the money, and in order to get the money, every day you have to make a videotape, which you snail mail back to the network. So every night you're looking at the videotapes from 3 days ago. This is before, like, the internet. And the hunters, they're called hunters in the game, they're anonymous. So you're walking down the street, and the meter maid could kill you. But if I learned something making all these movies with Joel Silver, like you mentioned earlier, is he used to always say, the movies we make, Steve, they're hate movies. It's like a love story. It's a cute meet. You have a couple of dates. You fall in love. You break up, and you get married. But our movies are hate movies. It's a cute meet. You have a couple of fights, and one kills the other. So that's how we sort of evolved in looking at television at the time. It's like wrestling. And the game shows in the 1980s were already Wheel of Fortune and the Bells and the Whistles, the $10,000 Pyramid. So we knew that the game show portion of the show had become entertaining. And so the evolution of the thing was, you have Arnold. We've got to believe the audience is going to tune in and watch the game show. It can't be a guy with a microphone and, you know, and people handing out envelopes. So it had to sort of evolve. Now, we got a lot of things wrong. You know, there's no flat screen TVs. People say that he's just like Trump, but Killian at least doesn't tweet. And the one thing that was deliberate, everybody says, oh, they have the cassettes, but at this time in the Soviet Union, behind the Iron Curtain, the samizdat, the illegal circulation of literature, was done on mimeograph machines and dittos because the printing press was so police. So you see when she goes, gets the data from the network, that there is some kind of digital data, but so it wasn't that we didn't think they'd invent something new. That's why she has the illegal cassettes. So there was an evolution, and of course, we said, all right, the game, it's got to be, you know, it's a two-hour movie, so we said it's a three-hour, you know, a game. So there's an evolution there. But what we have to remember, at this time, we already had a president who was an actor. Right as we were shooting the movie, Reagan gave a speech where he said, and now, one probably the speech to the nation, and he said, right now, as we think, our brave men and women in costume are serving overseas. He actually said this. Like he crossed the streams in his mind. So, you know, I did the most preposterous things I could think of. You know, get me the president's agent. The president has an agent. The Department of Justice Entertainment Division, you know. It's scary, like, how we sort of slipped into this.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not my fault.
No one's blaming you. Now, personally, this movie's literally 30 years old. When's the last time you've seen it?
Well, every week I'm like Miss Havisham. I watch all my no.
Oh,
no.
You're sitting in your rocking chair.
No. I probably haven't seen. I think probably like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I'm flipping channels. The one thing that drives me crazy about this movie is, as originally when we were doing the picture, at someone he says we charge nominal rate for the software. He names a company. That's the real name of the company. We were doing the movie. A company came in and they said we have this new thing called synth espions. You don't have to risk the necks of the stuntmen. We can, you know, so they showed us, you know, a sequence of a stuntman that was digital. But this is 10, 12 years before Tobey Maguire. And even if you remember the Spider-Man and Doc Octopus, there's like a digital valley of the stunts. So we said, no, we're going to use the stuntman. But the one thing that was intriguing was when the stuntman wasn't moving, the face substitution was really good. And the executive producer of the movie was Rob Cohen, who's done Triple X and Fast and Furious and a lot of other movies. But he's famous for his like first week in Hollywood, like fresh out of college. He got a job as a story analyst at Universal Studios. And his first day at work, they say, read the script and do the report. And some of you know what the reader report looks like. You have boxes and you say, you know, characterization, relevance, you know. And he gives it top boxes. So his supervisor says, look, this is your first day. We don't like sprinkle fairy dust on everything. You're not going to last here if you don't have some judgment. Go back and do this again. And he says, I know how to read a script. You know, I know how to read. You know, I like took a literature course 101. You know, all right, fine. You want to send that in? I wash my hands. Send it in. And it was the sting. So to this day, and I just had, had a conversation with Rob today. On his office wall, he has the memo from his boss. I'm warning you. Don't send us in, right? And then, of course, the movie was history. So after they showed us this demonstration, I said, you know, it doesn't work with the stunt, but that face substitution, that works if the guy's not moving. Why don't we do what they did in The Sting? Because if you remember The Sting, at the end of the movie, Robert Redford, at the end of the movie, it looks like Robert Redford has double-crossed Paul Newman, and they kill each other, right? Yeah. And the real audience is shocked, and the people that they're, like, conning, like, run out because they don't want to be arrested. Right? And then they get up, and they realize they're shot blank. So I said, we can do that in this movie digitally. So as written and as shot, the scene where Jesse Ventura kills them both was presented to you as if it were real. And we had a test screening. We go out towards Palm Springs. You want to go out, get out of town where there's presumably real people, but also so a rival studio executive doesn't stumble into your screening.
And you chose Palm Springs.
And I did not see, I never saw an audience react to a movie go that batshit crazy in that sequence until later on in the test of Die Hard. Because when Jesse Ventura, like, killed Maria Cachino Alonso, broke her neck, complete silence. I mean, I did the same thing in Die Hard 2 where we couldn't believe anything. We would crash the airplane, and I remember typing that the little girl's teddy bear gets the seatbelt. You know, I go, the audience, you know, and the audience is stunned. We killed all those people, you know.
The look on your face.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I'm cackling when I type it. So anyway, that was the reaction. And then when he kills Maria, and then Arnold gets up and beats the living days out, daylights out of Jesse Ventura, and there were old ladies, like the one in the movie, says, "Kill him, Arnold." It was like the hammer killing in Drive, right? And then at the last, and he beats the living hell out of Jesse Ventura, and then at the last minute, Jesse Ventura kills Arnold. And the audience was, remember, this is like 1987. This is not seven. This is 1987. You don't kill a leading lady, right? And we had like 700 people in the screening. And then after it's over, then you see the scene where Mick Fleetwood in it. And I'll tell you, the most accurate prediction in the movie is what Mick Fleetwood looks like now.
I had that exact note.
Somebody tweeted that today. He looks exactly like that.
He really does.
Like that. So then he comes in and he says, "Look," he says, "we just taped the last 5 minutes of the show," and then you, the audience, sees that they mind fucked the fictional audience. Well, anyway, because it was a test screening, and you know, test screenings put together at the last minute. In fact, as you may know, when you do a movie in the contract for the stars, you have the ADR. They can come in for a few days to re-record lines. So we're getting ready for the test screening, and they say, "Well, you know, it's all last minute scrambling," they said, "Well, you can't have Arnold come in and burn him up." So, and I said, I'm famous from Silver Lake to Malibu for my Arnold impression. And I've punked so many studio executives as Arnold, say, "Listen, I've seen my trailer. It's not as big as what's in my contract, you know. And this guy D'Souza, he's giving me a hard time." And they, "Oh, well, you know," and then I stick my head, "God damn it, you did that, D'Souza, it's you again." So I actually looped some of his lines for the test screening. In the prison sequence, when they break out, some of that time, "If you do it outside," that's me in there, like, because the sound editors got confused.
Just the test screenings or in the final cut?
No, it by accident, and they got confused, and some of my dialogue is still in the movie. Like, he had the split, that's me.
When Buzzsaw gets...
He had the split, and also there's a lot of lines here. At the end of the movie, I'm adding jokes, you know?
Yeah,
you know, he's walking away. So anyway... because it's a test screening, we had things as shot missing. Some of the scenes, like in the slums, the screen is blank. You know, it's a test screening. And the scene where they do the digital mat, it said shot missing, and some of that was black and white. So in 700 people, there were like 12 people who said, "I didn't understand how the audience in the movie was fooled." So some, you know, idiot network studio executive says, "Oh, we got a problem. These people don't understand it, but I can fix it. I'm good in post. Let's take those two scenes and reverse them. Uh-huh. I'm good in post." So that's what drives. So anyway, with the Blu-ray, you guys can like put those two scenes back in the right order. But imagine the effect the audience it would have on the viewer.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's my biggest, you know, problem with the movie. And I think the movie would have been a bigger hit. You want to, just like a Broadway show, you want them humming the last song in Hamilton when they come out of the theater. You want the last 10 minutes. So there's a little lull in the movie where it's like watching the replay of the Super Bowl, you know?
Yeah.
That's my biggest misgiving about the movie. But it really holds up really well, and now it has all this, like, you know, added value and this strange subtext. And, like, we're leaving the theater, but we can't leave the movie.
I I just want to say for the record, this is word for word. How did Mick Fleetwood end up in this? His look is one of the many things this film got right.
Yeah. That was a question. One of your suggested questions.
How did he end up in this? Because he before or after wasn't known for.
Oh no, he was well known. I think somebody knew him or was friendly with him and said, you know, can we do a cameo for him? And I said, yeah, he should be Mick Fleetwood. It's like his music has been censored in the future. Now, one of the things we got wrong is, you know, who thought Star Trek would come back? You know, so like we say in the amazing future year 2017, who would Star Trek? What's that? You know, like everybody who remembers is dead. You know, so like so that one is that joke, you know, falls flat.
So this was directed by Paul Michael Glaser, but apparently went through at least four other.
Yeah, this is
directors?
Crazy. Usually there's like, you know, nine writers and like, you know, and one director, but this is sort of the opposite. I survived the entire experience as a screenwriter. The original director was George Cosmatos, who did like Tombstone,
Rambo, right?
And a great guy, a friend of mine. He died a few years ago in a really strange tragedy. He had a brain tumor, and they operated on the brain tumor, and he went blind as a result of the brain tumor. But if you ever read the book... By the man who mistook his wife for a hat, by Oliver Sacks. He was married for 35 years, a wonderful woman, and she had died of cancer, and now he's like dying of cancer. But it affected his brain, and he had this thing like in the Oliver Sacks book where he did not know he was blind, and he forgot his wife was dead. So you would visit him, he'd say, "Well, you know my wife, honey. Why don't you get Steve a beverage? You're looking well, Stephen. You know." So it's sort of, I guess, if you have to go out, so way to go. Anyway, when we did the movie, his family had suffered under the Nazi occupation of Greece. So we have this future dystopia. It's obviously a fascist state, and you see people suffering in the streets. But in the draft I did for George, there were roundups. There were concentration camps. He went, like, way into that.
Was it also set in a shopping mall?
No, his vision was that the 1% that people lived in was a complete, like, biodome. And he wanted to film all of the upscale scenes in the Edmonton Mall, which is the biggest shopping center in the world at that time. So we were going to shoot in Canada, and we scouted it. And then there was going to be, and then he broke out of the city. It was going to be a river raft chase. And I think he was just trying to get the movie back into the wilderness where he had done Rambo. He wanted the whole chasing part of the game to be in the wilderness. I guess he just wanted to get back on comfortable turf. And then when the budget was done for that draft, it was... $27 million, and they said no. We're doing this picture for like $18 million, and he said he can't do it for $18 million. He left, and he was right. The movie ended up costing $24 million. So the next director came in was Alex Cox, who really wanted to do it. Sid and Nancy. He really wanted to do it, but he was still could not get out of Walker in time to do our movie. So then there was a Swiss director whose name escapes me now. He came and went in 2 weeks. I saw the back of his head in the elevator. And then we had an English director, Ferdinand Fairfax, who had just made a pretty good, you know, pirate movie called Nathan Hayes, which he was convinced, and he was every day with him. He was complaining, "Fucking Paramount, fuck me, man." He was convinced that the international arm of Paramount that had bought the picture. When they showed it to the main management, they get Steven Spielberg has a movie in development that we start in 8 months. It has a Venn diagram of a weird cult and stuff like that. So he figured they buried his movie. Anyway, he had an interesting idea that the movie should be the actual broadcast, which would have been some narrative problems because, you know, how did he get in trouble and, you know, and stuff like that. And he also was making it very, you know, making it very, very British. And he said, you know, on an English crew, you have the tea lady who comes around with a cart with, like, tea and biscuits. And his idea was that when the tea lady came through, the show stopped, the crew stopped, the stalker stopped, and the runner stopped, and they all took a break and had a snack. And then they started up again. It was sort of like in The Man Who Would Be King when the holy men come through. So anyway, it was kind of a Monty Python bridge too far, and before you could say, what is the capital of Assyria, he was gone. Right. Oh, I got some people that got that reference. So then Andy Davis, who later on did The Fugitive, but at this time had done justice. At this time, he went off and did a movie with Steven Seagal instead called Above the Law. So he started the movie. He worked for a week, and he was falling behind schedule. And I got a call from Rob Cohen. He says, listen, I need you to come in come to Daly's right now. We have a real problem. And I said, well, I just picked my daughter up like dance class or gymnastics. I said, all right, bring her. I know her. So I go to the screening room, and Arnold comes from the set, and he's in the yellow outfit. The director is not there, which is, you know, at Daly's. And now they start running. It's the ice skating sequence with Sub-Zero. So it's a stunt sequence, so it's just pretty much, you hear the crew talking, and, you know, there's no sound effects, there's no dialogue. So the projector's running, it's like the beginning of Citizen Kane, there's smoke, and it's just running, and it gets kind of monotonous, and there's the smoke curling up. And then I hear a voice saying, ew, that's gross. Mister, can you put out that stinky cigar? And this is my daughter, who's like here now, but, you know, so I go, oh, well, okay. And then Arnold, very chivalrously, puts the cigar out, and as the chivalry extends, because then she falls asleep on him. Right, like, because, you know, it's just the drone of the projector. All right, so anyway, I don't know why I'm here, and then I see what happened. In a meeting earlier when we were developing the picture, Andy said, listen, I have a great idea. At the end of the movie, when they break into the studio, they're cornered, they're trapped, they're all going to get died. They overestimated the security guards in the studio, and then Arnold reaches into his pocket, and he takes out one of the exploding hockey pucks, and he throws it, and he kills the guards. And then somebody... You know, Rob and I look at each other, and, you know, I leave this remark to him. He says, that makes Arnold the biggest shitheel, like, in movie career, that he had this thing in his pocket for the whole movie while the entire supporting cast is getting killed and uses it to save his own ass. So they say, we're not doing that. But then he's behind schedule several days. He shot this. He improvised that scene, and he had Arnold pocket one of the hockey pucks. So that was, you know, so then Andy was out. And Rob had been a director on Miami Vice. And Michael Mann now is a guest star. The two guest stars here is when they went to hire a writer for the screenplay, Rob Cohen called up Joel Silver, gave me a high recommendation. I had done 48 Hours and Commando at that time. So now Michael Mann came to the rescue and recommended Paul Michael Glazer, who had done some of the very key seminal episodes of Miami Vice, like Smuggler's Blues and The Return of Calderon, some of the ones that really built the show in the first 13 episodes. And he had a whole career as an actor and then a director in television. And now we're behind schedule after four directors coming and going, and the picture has a hard release date. He was able to hit the ground running and make the movie and finish the movie.
How is it for you, as the creator of the whole blueprint for this film?
Well, no, there's a novel. Again, there's a novel.
It varies quite differently. The ending of that is completely different and bleak, too. He flies a plane.
We didn't want to kill Arnold, but the end of the movie is Arnold hijacks an airplane. Not Arnold, Ben Richards hijacks a plane.
That's fair
and
to
crashes
call him
into
Arnold.
The network tower.
Yeah.
So that's one more, you know, we're spared that
And
one.
His daughter and his wife are murdered.
Yeah, they're both, yeah. He's on the show and they say, listen, you know, we didn't want to tell you, but your wife and daughter were murdered. We didn't do it. It was a real crime. And they make him the same offer, you could be a stalker. Hunter. But again, the hunters on the show are kind of anonymous.
But it's fair to say that you really put your stamp on this, and then when four to five other directors come in, how does it feel when they take it in these vastly different directions? Do you feel like, this is my job, I'll just go with them, or do you fight them on
certain
things?
Well, no, again, this was kind of a studio, this was more in an era when studio executives would have a heavier hand.
Okay.
And again, Rob had a lot of street cred with directors. He had been like a studio executive, he had been a television director, so when he gives you a note, you know what I mean, he's going to get more respect than maybe, you know, someone who comes out with a business degree. In fact, you know, at one point he would say to me, listen, I don't think this guy Fairfax is going to work out, but you're going to have to endure his notes and try and do his notes until we see where this goes. So I, you know, knew I had my time in the barrel, and I was bending in each direction. Like, for example, The version for George Cosmatos was much darker. It had concentration camps. And he wanted, and I was fighting it, he wanted the girl to be, in the picture, to be a revolutionary. And she talked Arnold into becoming, joining the revolution, sort of like his cohorts here do. And so when George left, I said, listen, I did that because George wanted to do it. It makes no sense. She should be one of the 1%. She should be 180 degrees away from her. She should be a network tool. Then there's somewhere for them to both go. So, you know, you sort of, you know, it's like you sort of bend, you know, what is it, the willow tree bends and the oak tree. So I bent with it. But what was unusual in it that Rob, who I subsequently really did, I've done three pictures for him. He was saying, listen, you just got to put up with this now, but I think at the end we're going to protect, you know, the design we have for this movie. Huh. So ultimately, you know, I came out with what the intention was finally at the end. And by the time Paul Glaser came in, there was no notes. He said, look, this is the script. You know, like, you know, we're starting in 1 week, and there's no time for any notes at all. I would say that except for this sequence at the end, which really bothers me to this day, I'm not sure, you know, I want to tell you, you know, my dying words, the fucking last reel, that studio executive. But other than that, I'm pretty pleased with it.
Well, let's talk a bit about Die Hard. I mean, I'm certainly
Thank you. Not alone.
It's just revered as a perfect film. It's amazing to me. This also, at one point, was at least a potential vehicle for Schwarzenegger as well, right?
Yes.
Even a sequel to Commando.
That's not true? No, there's an urban myth that I keep shooting down, which is that Die Hard was the Commando 2 sequel, which was never shot.
Are you saying I can't trust IMDb trivia?
No, it's still on the shelf. The Commando 2 script had one idea, which was that after the events of the first movie, Arnold would have 15 minutes of fame for blowing up half of Los Angeles. So in the sequel, he'd already left the army in the first picture. He started a security firm. And he gets hired by a big industrialist who says, listen, this crazy world we live in, you know, executives get kidnapped, there's crime, our people around the world. I want you to hire my security people so I have the best people to protect my executives around the world. And I want you to make my office building an impregnable fortress so it's secure. And Arnold does that, but it turns out that the guy is actually an international arms dealer, right? And then when a shipment goes wrong, Arnold is framed for it. And the guy takes cover in his building with Ray Don Chong from the first movie and Arnold's daughter now. So Arnold has to break into the building that he made impregnable and defeat all the people, plus the most vicious, like, you know, dogs, plus robot security droids. So if there was, somehow the idea of Arnold trying to get into a building got conflated in people's minds with, you know, the hero of Die Hard trying to get out of a building.
Interesting.
But Die Hard is based on a novel called Nothing Lasts Forever, which Larry Gordon at Fox immediately changed because there was a chick flick with the same title written by Sidney Sheldon some years earlier. But a good bar bet is you're in a bar and you say, you know that character that Bruce Willis played in Die Hard 2, 3, 4? Who was the first person to play that part in
Frank
what
Sinatra.
Movie? That's the answer, Frank Sinatra. Then grab your money before they beat you up. Because Nothing Lasts Forever is the sequel to a book called The Detective, which Frank Sinatra made a movie of. And if you see that movie in a rerun, you see a detective who's estranged from his wife. They're having marital difficulties. So Fox was legally obligated to go back to Sinatra. And fortunately, he said, I'm too old and too rich to make this movie, which is good because the chases in the building would have been with Rascal Scooters. So once he said no, we changed the name of the character from John Leyland to John McClane to sever the legal obligations to Sinatra's company. Now there was an earlier draft which Jeb Stuart did, which hove very closely to the book. It had several important changes that Jeb did. One was the character's no longer like my age now. He's not a retired cop. He's a younger cop. And the hostage in the building is his wife, not his daughter. Because in the continuity of the books, the breakup was in the movie The Detective, the divorce. And they never got back together. And also, she died in the takeover. And they were real terrorists. You know, when the book was written, the Bader-Meinhof gang was going on in Germany. So by the time we made the movie, oh, terrorism, that's over, that's not going on. That's a Chuck Norris movie. In the book, you're entirely in the guy's head. You only see what he sees, you only hear what he hears. And a lot of the running time of the book, the chapters, is him remembering when the daughter was young, his wartime experiences. He realized that the leader of the German gang was someone that he had captured in World War II, but was strangely released from the prison camp in Germany because he had criminal soldiers. So that took up time. But in the movie, you can't sustain a movie, you know, just in the head of that one person. And when the book was written, the CB craze was going on. Do you remember Good Buddy, all those convoy movies?
Yeah.
So the guy that he communicated with outside was a gypsy taxi driver. And there was later on a cop came in. So Jeb very importantly made it the wife, not the daughter, and blended the cop and the gypsy cab driver. But I was brought in because I'd already done several movies for this team, and they knew I could add humor and plot twists. And so the big plot twist was I invented this preposterous lock, right? There's like 9 locks you can't get through, and the final lock is an underwater cable that goes to Tokyo.
And plays
that
Beethoven.
That you have to turn the power. I mean, people believe this shit, you know, but it's sort of like reverse engineered it. And it's also preposterous that the leader of this crime doesn't tell everybody. They're saying, but the police here, he says, the police were always part of the plan, you know. Like, so it makes no sense, but it makes you root for, Hans Gruber because you want to find out what the fuck he's up to. That was his first part. Joel Silver and John McTiernan went to see Liaison Dangereux. Did I say that right? He was in Broadway, and they said, "Here's our guy." And what's interesting, there's an attitude often that directors don't want writers on the set, and this is because some writers don't know how to behave on the set. Like the star comes over and says, "Give me something for my character," and like a writer says, "I think you're claustrophobic," and then the director goes, "What the fuck is he doing? Why is he cringing in the elevator? Did he talk to the writer?" But I had, you know, started out as a television writer, and I worked my way up the food chain till I was a showrunner, night writer. Probably some of you had the toys.
Yeah.
All right. So I know how to talk to actors, and when somebody else is director, I don't talk to the actors unless they say go talk to the actors. So what happened was the original script was passed on by Arnold, by Stallone, by Richard Gere, by Jimmy Kahn, by Burt Reynolds, who had done a lot of movies. And it was because at this time, and I was partially responsible, and so was, you know, Rambo and Commando, you had these superhuman testosterone kind of characters, and this character is like a normal guy. So that version of the script, which did not have the mitigating humor, and also did not have the plot twist in terms, because they were really terrorists and stuff like that, for whatever reason, everybody passed on that. And that, and a famous story out of desperation, they said, all right, let's use Bruce. We have a contract here with him and Fox. And he got the then amazing price of $5 million. The very next day, Richard Dreyfuss fired his agent. So I have an Academy Award, and I don't get $5 million. So it sort of rocked Hollywood. And they said to me, now listen, just as a formality, go see him. But if he has any changes, run them by us, because we're like behind schedule already because of trying to get a star. And don't promise him you're not going to make any changes, because he's fed up to here with the pink, blue, green pages from Moonlighting. So I go to meet him for the first time, and we discover we grew up like about 35 miles apart. He's like 5 years younger than me. We both went to the same places in Atlantic City. We talked about playing, you know, Army under the boardwalk, and then we start talking about the kids' shows we used to watch on the same Philadelphia stations, including Roy Rogers, who used to say, "Yippee-ki-yay, kids." So that's how that came into the movie. So finally he says, "Boy, this is funny. Oh, there's so much fun. We should have some fun in this movie." And I go, "Well, they told me you don't want any changes." "No, please." So then I was on the set, and the changes were happening so fast, and the picture is better for it. I'll give you a famous example, two famous examples. One is, one of the things that drove us crazy is the way the movie is set up is that Bruce really can't fall in hate with Hans. Because if they meet, they'll kill them. So it was driving us crazy. And as we're shooting, Joel Silver is, "We got to have him fall in hate. We got to have him fall in hate. How do we do it?" So one day on the set, when our tea lady comes around for the snacks, someone says to Alan Rickman, "Alan, a lot of the UK actors do an American accent. Do you do an American accent?" And he said, "Well, I don't know if I do an American accent per se, but I do, you know, like a California one." So everybody cracks up, and I go, "Oh my God, that's it." And I go and I grab Joel Silver and I go, listen. And he says, "So what?" I said, "If he's just a voice on the radio. He can mind fuck Bruce. He can meet Bruce." And then Tom McTiernan comes over, and John is a very meticulous planner. He actually went to AFI as a writer, not a director. So he goes, no, he sees him kill Tagagi. And I said, "Well, when do you shoot that?" And the first AD says, "We shoot that tomorrow." And I said, "Can you shoot that in a manner in which he doesn't see him. And he says, I'm not going to do the over-the-head fake thing. I said, it's got to be a plausible way. So we go over to the set, and John goes around like, you know, this with the hand, you know. And finally he says, all right, this big table with a giant solid leg, if we move it over there, I can stage it. Great, great. He says, no, not great. You got to go write the scene. So they throw somebody out of the nearest office to the soundstage, and they give me a typewriter. By this time, I'm on a computer, so I'm, carriage return. So I go write the scene in about, like, 3 hours, and I bring it back. It's okay. It's in the movie, and that's how that famous scenery gets me. But everybody says to me, how does Bruce know he's not a hostage? And people come up to me and go, I know, I know. It's because he offers him one of those foreign cigarettes, and he accepts it, and no American would accept a foreign cigarette. And somebody says, oh, because the weight of the gun is different with the magazine that's empty, but no, that's before he gives him the, you know, how does he know? Here's how he knows. Originally, when they get off the truck at the beginning of the movie, they, you know, dan, 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 dan. And by the way, nobody gets killed in this movie for the first 20 minutes. I mean, it's a lot of restraint for a movie nowadays. Right? So the truck pulls in, and the terrorists get off, and they walk towards the camera very dramatically, and they go into the building. Originally, they walked off the truck, and they came out, and the camera craned up, and you saw them in a circle, and Alan Rickman said in German, synchronize your watches. And they all put their arms out in a circle with the camera going down like a Hitchcock shot, and they all went beep. They all had the same tag, your watch. Now, if you notice, the first guy that Bruce kills, almost by accident, rolling down the steps, he searches the body, he looks at the IDs, right? He steals the cigarettes, which is a laugh. He goes like this. And then he looks at the watch, which gets another laugh because you're thinking that he might be stealing the watch. But as he kills each guy, he notices they all have the same watch. Now, you remember the scene in the movie, he talks to the cop outside, Dwayne Robinson, and he says, I think these guys are professionals. Their IDs are too good. There's no labels in their clothes. And they all have the same watch that was in the movie. I think he'd just be a bartender. Now, here's what happened, right? As we're making the movie, the one thing we had not figured out was how are they going to get away with it? We have a line of dialogue where he says, well, if they think you're alive, they pursue you, but if they think you're dead, you can escape. So we had that line of dialogue, but how are they getting away? So we're down to like 8 days of filming left on the movie, and we still have to say, we got to explain how they were going to get away.
You've not figured this out at this
point? No. So finally I said...
I almost don't want to hear that this film was left to the wire.
Finally I say, listen... I'm going to rip myself off. I did a TV movie pilot 2 years ago that aired once. Nobody's seen it. It'll never be on home video, called Will Eisner's The Spirit. It was before the Frank Miller's Will Eisner's The Spirit. And in that, the villain, if you know the comic book, who was, what was her name? What? Somebody must know it here. I forget her name. Anyway, she was an arch villain, a very sexy villain. She was so evil, she was going to blow up a children's hospital and escape in a fake ambulance. So I said, let's do that again. Right. And nobody saw it. Nobody remembered we did it. Since then, it came out on home video, and it's a cult following. Anyway, so we say, that's it. And we shoot the scene at the end of the movie where Argyle's in the basement, and then he sees one of the handful of terrorists who hasn't been killed, roll the ambulance out, and he knocks him out. Now we have the first cut of the movie. We're watching this, a handful of people. There's John McTiernan, studio executives, my wife and I, Joel Silver. We're watching the movie. It's all working, temporary music, a couple of shots missing, dun, dun, dun. And then they get off the truck, and we go, oh, shit. Because while they're standing there saying, synchronize your watches, you see there's no ambulance in the truck. Because we hadn't thought of that when we shot it. So now John says to the editor, get the scissors in there, cut. At the cut as soon as you can when they get off the truck so we don't see there's no ambulance. But now, without synchronize your watches, all of these moments where Bruce looks at each guy's watch makes no sense. So if you see the movie again on cable or Blu-ray, when they get off the truck, don't look at them, look in the truck, and you'll see, as for a split second, there's no ambulance. And when Bruce offers... a cigarette to Alan Rickman, Bruce sees the watch. You see his eyes totally look at the watch. And that's how he knows that he is one of the terrorists. Wow. Funny. But it got crazier. I would go home And one of the things that made this a richer movie is Bruce was still shooting Moonlighting during the daytime, and finally John McTiernan came to me and said, listen, we're killing this guy. He's in every scene. He's working the daytime. Why don't you start expanding the other characters in the movie, and we can give Bruce some days off? And so that's why the asshole reporter's part got bigger and bigger, and that's why Holly's part got bigger and bigger, and she had all these confrontation scenes with Alan Rickman, because every time those scenes are happening with other people, like when he goes after the housekeeper and says, and again, like this is like the other movie, like ice, remember he says the housekeeper, ice,
yeah.
Right? Right? So Bruce, you know, gets this a day off. So that made the movie richer.
When you guys were making, you're responsible for some of the great Schwarzenegger vehicles and that classic 80s action style. This movie plays against that completely. Were you aware that you were starting something fresh and new with this at the time?
Well, we realized with Die Hard that this was a realistic hero that was kind of a new paradigm that was forgotten. In fact, the greatest compliment I got after people saw the movie is they said, Steve, I thought he was going to die. Because, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, you know, Paul Newman or Burt Lancaster could be in a movie and they, Frank Sinatra, Ron Ryan's Express, the hero could win but die.
Yeah, the killers,
you know,
with Lancaster.
You know, so it happened once in a while. So the fact that, now that since then he's become a superhero, you know, yeah. In the sequels. In fact, in the first sequel, in order to try and get that vulnerability in there, that's why I crashed the plane. Because we knew he'd live. Because of the first movie, but I had to happen to have a big colossal failure. So that's why I invented his desperate attempt to, like, signal the plane and
not
land it.
Did you have any pushback on that from studios?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the studio insisted. They said, you can't kill all those people. We'll lose the audience. It has to be a UPS plane. So they actually spent money, and they filmed a UPS model plane crashing as a fallback position in case the audience left the theater when we crashed the plane after we put the seatbelt on the little girl's teddy bear.
Yeah, they're worried about their packages.
Yeah. So they say, well, only two people died and a lot of packages, you know. So fortunately, you know, the audience loved the movie at the test screening, and we kept in the plane full of people. For a while, if you didn't count George Lucas blowing up Princess Leia's planet, that was the highest body count movie because of the model airplane we crashed with the imaginary people in it. Anyway, the second picture was based on a novel, nothing to do with the first series of novels, called
58 Minutes,
yeah. Which was about Arab terrorists who took over an airplane. And it was all different characters. And the studio said, it was the Monday after Die Hard opened, they said, we're making a sequel. And they said, we have a script that's lying around, we think is it. And I was, that script had already been written, but it was based on the novel. And I put in all the characters from the first movie. Reginald L. Johnson was on a TV series, we couldn't get him. And again, the same idea that I, and again, maybe this contributed to the legend on IMDb, the idea I had for Commando 2, that the experiences of the first picture made you notorious, we played a lot in the second movie. People said, I remember you were on TV. You know, because Bruce, well, because yeah. the first movie was on television. You know, television is covering the hostage situation in Century City. So we played that in the second movie, that Bruce had a moment of celebrity and did not like it. And I mean, the villain says, I think you're over your head on Charlie Rose, he said.
Oh, yeah.
There's a line of dialogue. And one of the things that was in the first two movies, which was then lost, he was a vulnerable guy, and he was also a technophobe. You may remember that he had a lot of, you know, he hated technology, and he hated flying, and all that stuff. Now he's flying airplanes, in the, you know, in the latter
yeah, right.
movies. But I think, you know, he's gotten to be superhuman, and he's, you know, flying helicopters, and he's in Russia, and shooting airplanes, jumping out of buildings. The fact that we're onto something really good, it was proven. I used to, when I make my earlier movie, 48 Hours in Commando, right after we'd wrap a movie, we'd make the airline and television version. Like, you know, Yippee-ki-yay, Melon Farmer, you know, that kind of, right? So I would bring home the videotape of my movies to show to my kids because the movies were too rough for them. So Die Hard was the first picture that I took my kids to see in the movie theater. Because I was protecting them from these, you know, R-rated movies. So at the moment where Bruce sees all the terrorists come in, and he realizes he's got, you know, he's sort of, it's kind of like, you know, what do you call it? There's a bad term for acting, but he had to do it, like, looks at his gun, and they've got, you know, like, you know, bazookas, and he runs upstairs. And the hero spends the first act, this is why people didn't want to do it, trying to call the police.
Uh-huh.
That's what he does in the first act of the movie. So he runs upstairs, my son says, Dad, your hero's chicken shit. And I said, you're 10 years old. Where did you hear that word? Not from my movies. But that's when I knew wrong. And the movie holds up. I mean, the only thing that dates that movie is Bonnie Medeo's shoulder pads and hairstyle. Other than that, the movie, you know...
Well, that's coming back around, so you're fine.
Yeah.
Just one or two more things before we got to wrap this up. Now, there is a connection between Schwarzenegger and these films. If I'm not mistaken, in Die Hard 2, the General Franco Nero's part is from the fictional country of Valverde, which is also the same country as in Commando.
Yes, when I was doing the Knight Rider and the Bionic show, so that's my first job, so the $6 million Bionic Woman, Harv Bennett later on did all the Star Trek movies. We were always doing Cold War stories, always had commie villains. So we used to always invent fake countries, because if you did a story and you said, Steve, you know, like Oscar Goldman, the interior minister of El Salvador is actually a communist agent, like we would get sued.
Yeah.
So we invented all these fake countries. So I invented Valverde then on an episode of like the Bionic Woman or something. We used it once. My favorite country I made up on the Bionic Woman for an inside joke that like nobody in America got was... what the hell is that? What's the lake over in North Hollywood? Toluca. There was an apartment building called the Toluca Embassy. So I made up a country called Toluca so we could show Lindsay Wagner go into the Toluca Embassy. But anyway, I recycled Valverde for Commando. And we said... the president of Valverde trusts you, and you can get to him, go kill him. Then, without asking my permission, they used Valverde again in Predator. They said, we're crossing the Guatemalan border into Valverde. So then, when we got into Die Hard 2, we actually have consistent history. If you listen to the newscast, right, of the Valverde, and that was the thinly disguised Panama... You know, the whole thing with Noriega.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you listen to the newscast, it's in the movie. I always do these newscasts. He's talking some of the history of Valverde, you know, from the earlier movies. And there's a theory online called the Valverde movie universe. And they said that it's even beyond the Marvel universe. If you add up all the movies that Valverde is in, right, because all the Predator movies now roll into it, these movies, and also because Gail Wallins, the newscaster that's in Die Hard, also is in the movie Ricochet I did with Denzel Washington, playing the same character. So that rolls Denzel Washington's Ricochet into the Valverde universe. And there's somebody created a web page for this fictional country. It's on Wikipedia, Valverde. And somebody else has this theory, you know, like the theory that like all the Pixar movies are connected.
Yeah.
Somebody has a chart with graphs and circles of all the movies that are part of the Valverde verse.
Yeah. All right. Let's wrap it up with just a little bit about Hudson Hawk.
Hudson Hawk. Okay. All right.
Look at the appreciation that has come. I saw this. Yeah. Very close to my 18th birthday in the theater. I've always loved this movie. Talk about the reception and the history of this film a little bit, and then we'll wrap it up.
Bruce had just a good experience doing the first two Die Hard pictures. He had a deal with TriStar, which is now Sony, to make a movie. And he said, I want to do a cat burglar movie. I want to do a movie like To Catch a Thief with Cary Grant. And that was the script I wrote. Anyway, the movie starts... And we're over in Italy making the movie. And one night in the trailer, the phone rings. And it's Mark Canton calling Bruce Willis saying, we just had a test screening of, Bonfire of the Vanities.
Oh,
where Bruce was already, people were controversial, he was playing a Sweet Street British, but they made him an American. And Mark Canton says, we had a test of the movie, and you tested through the roof. We are recutting the movie to make your part bigger. So we don't hear the phone call. Bruce gets off and says, it was Mark Canton. They just had a test screening of Bonfire of the Vanities. I tested through the roof. They're recutting the picture. And Joel Silver kicks me and says, fucking Mark Canton just fucked his movie and ours. Watch what happens this week. And so now Bruce decided, as a big fan of the Three Stooges, that the movie should get crazier and crazier and crazier. And he brought in Dan Waters, a great guy, to make it crazier and crazier. And finally, the studio calls me up and says, we need you. You get along with Bruce. You're both from the old neighborhood. We're sending you and your wife, all expenses paid. We have no money to pay you, but we're sending you over, putting you up in a, renting a villa for you in Abbey Antica. You got to take the pencil out of Bruce's hand and put the script back to the one you took. So I go there, and Joel Silver meets me and says, Bruce hired us. It's not our job to tell him he can't make the movie he wanted. He brought us in. It's the studio executives, and the studio executive's coming over here tomorrow. So the studio executive comes over the next day, and he said, he arrives late at night, and he says, what are we filming tomorrow? It's a robbery sequence. He says, well, there's no dialogue in that scene, so we'll talk the next day. And the next day, he says, listen, I'm sorry I couldn't get down to the set. I was on the phone with the studio. I'm going, with the time difference, they're all asleep. So this guy finds 3 days in a row to avoid belling the cat. Then it's the weekend, and then the following Monday, he says, the Murders have to go back. So nobody tells Bruce to stop rewriting the movie and also directing the movie. So the movie, you know, becomes the movie that Bruce wanted to make. And so the whole thing that they rob according to the songs, these are all the things that he wanted to do. And it all, in my opinion, it all could have worked. There was one mistake that makes it not work. I know people like it today, but even in a Disney movie, the villain is serious. If you look at Aladdin, you can have the crazy parrot, the Jafar, they're on the way. But Jafar is deadly serious. Soon all Arabia will be under my sway. If only I married Princess Jafar. Right? But in this movie, the villains were stupid and silly. The underling, and that was a bridge too far, in my opinion. If the villain had, and talk about going with the vicissitudes, the first draft of that movie, the villain was going to be Josh, what's his name, from Lethal Weapon 2. Josh Ackland was the original villain of that movie, and they wanted to get him. And then Michael Lehman said, I have a better idea. Let's get Audrey Hepburn to be a female villain. So the first draft, where it was more straight, like it was, there was comedy relief. I mean, you see my movies as comedy relief. But the first draft of the movie, it was Josh Ackland was the villain. It was the same plot. He wanted to get the Da Vinci thing and the Da Vinci secret gold machine. Then the second draft, you made it Audrey Hepburn. And then by the time it got
was
crazy,
she on board for this?
No, they already had a conversation with her. But by the time it morphed into that it finally changed where Bruce said, hey, let's take the guy from the first movie and the girl from the second movie and make them a couple. And when we put the movie together, it became so kind of incomprehensible that the big reveal that they wanted this machine to make gold, they stay in the opening credits. You know, Leonardo da Vinci invented, it was a desperate attempt to have the movie pull together because it was almost improvised. Uh-huh. But like I said, I know it has a cult following today, and there's some great stuff in it, and it's a wonderful stuff, but they telegraph when the movie got everything written, you did not know till late in the movie what the hell the Da Vinci robberies were about. Did not know where it was going to make the gold machine. And the escape on the original Da Vinci glider was an 11th hour, save. It wasn't so the opening of this movie, they telegraph the glider, and they telegraph the gold machine, so there's nowhere to go.
Huh. Well, I hate it now.
All right. No. Like I said, there's a lot of great stuff in it, but I think if just the villains had been played straight, you know, it would have been better. Anyway,
well, thank God for James Coburn in there.
Yeah. No, that was look. I was great. We had a great time in Italy. I'll say that. Great food and great company, but it was just frustrating every day to see the movie, you know, getting off the rails to a great degree.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for Stephen D'Souza.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much, Stephen. That was really wonderful. I really appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Thanks to Brett Berg and Alamo Drafthouse and the Regent Theater. Have a good night. Drive safely, everybody.
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.